you just start by saying your name and what your current title is?
Okay, my name is Stanley Uliashek, Professor of Human Ecology at the School of Anthropology and Museum Ethnography at the University of Oxford.
Lovely, and you're also a Fellow of St Cross College.
And I'm a Fellow of St Cross College.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you to essentially tell me your life story, but in fairly short order. How did you first become interested in the kind of topics that you've been researching? And can you just give me the kind of headlines of your career steps up till 2020?
Short story. I graduated in biochemistry back in the day and have progressively moved from biochemistry to nutrition to public health nutrition when it really wasn't a subject. Way back in the 1980s, I worked in Papua New Guinea, was fascinated in this strange and remote place, and worked on nutritional ecology there because it seemed that the only ways of finding out why there were such high levels of undernutrition in the place where I was to look at the practice of food getting in all its forms, its sociality, the practices themselves, and finding out that the story was actually more complex than I anticipated. So I worked on undernutrition and infection. I graduated, got my first academic post at the University of Cambridge as a fledgling nutritional anthropologist when it didn't exist as a subject. They were looking for people and there were very few to be found. There was one other, Simon Strickland, who got the other job, which was at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Neither of us really knew what we were doing, and so we saw it fit to write a book together. So that was our first book. And through writing, we got to learn what it was we really thought we were thinking about and developing in this field, of subfield of nutritional anthropology.
But you were particularly looking at public health through a nutritional lens and in an anthropological context, is that?
Well, it started off in a public health way, but very rapidly became anthropology when I met some seminal figures who were out in the field in Papua New Guinea. I never studied with them, but they kind of became collaborators, co-constructors of a way of thinking in the field. So I was moving towards anthropology. In fact, when I was writing up my doctoral thesis, which was largely based on work in Papua New Guinea, my supervisor, who was a nutritionist, said, if you keep going on like this, you should find a supervisor in anthropology. And I said, no, I'll stay with you. But then my first job was in anthropology. Mm-hmm. So funny thing was that somehow I became an anthropologist on the hoof. The obesity work really came in an unlikely way because I wasn't interested so much in the public health and the medical aspects of obesity. I acknowledge their importance, but that's not really what I do. I became interested when I went back over two decades later to the populations I'd worked with in the 1980s and found that there was diabetes, there was hypertension, undernutrition, much less of a problem, but then emerging overweight, overnutrition in a rural place, a very difficult place where you might not expect to see people develop excess body fatness. So that was curious in a way. It wasn't the usual story of the people in my country, whether that country is the United States or the UK or Australia, are changing and this has a significant impact on their health. It was more about, well, it shouldn't be happening. It seems to be a curious phenomenon. And I really want to try to understand the pathway to this particular form of obesity, which then led me to think about different pathways to obesity, which is pretty much where I am now. Every country has a different trajectory, and that's what makes it interesting to study. It's also of huge importance, but it's interesting to study because you can then say, well, of all the different ways in which obesity could be produced, what are the particular pathways in this country? This country is different to Scotland, that's England, different to Scotland. Scotland's different to Italy, Italy's different to Japan, where there's very little obesity, even though I presented there about Pacific Islands obesity. I've also worked in the Cook Islands, which has now the highest level of obesity anywhere in the world. And at that time, I presented a comparison slide for Japan and said the rates of obesity are 2% in Japan. And most of the discussion centered around, why is there so much obesity in Japan? There shouldn't be any obesity in Japan at all, period.
But 2% is tiny compared with the United States.
Totally, totally so, totally so. A very, very, very small issue at all. But it's a matter of national pride to be thinking that there should be no obesity whatsoever.
So what are the you talked about these pathways being different from country to country. What are the elements of those pathways that you're interested in as an anthropologist?
I worked for the Foresight Obesity Think Tank in the early 2000s, mid-2000s. And this was the grouping that first published on obesity as complexity. It had been done before, but in a much more limited way.
What does that mean?
Well, a complex phenomenon is climate change, for example. Many things come together to create a perfect storm, and then when something moves from one state, a reasonably steady state, to another state, that's called a tipping. You tip into, you know, another state. Nobody sought obesity at all, and it seems to have emerged in the 1980s, 1990s, in the industrialized countries. More recently, 90s, 2000s, across the global south. And in the early 2000s, there were over 100 factors that contribute to obesity that were known, had been researched, had been studied, had been published. So it tells you immediately it's not if you do this, then that. It's the agglomeration of factors. And, you know, we can make an analogy with some cancers, for example, where cancer accrues across a lifetime, usually. And there are predisposing factors, they could be genetic factors, and then there are a number of triggers. And there may be a singular trigger. Smoking is I understand it to be a particular singular trigger for lung cancer, for example. But oftentimes there are multiple factors, so multi-hit factors. It's a multi-hit model. Mm-hmm. Similarly, for obesity, you could think about it as being a multi-hit model. But rather than there being, let's say, 10 or 20 known factors that could be those triggers, you have over 100.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be all of them.
Mm-hmm.
It could be any five or six of them.
And can you just pick a few as sort of examples of those that tend to come up?
Well,
I'm just trying to make the example a bit more concrete.
Well, there's life course issues that if you're breastfed, you're protected against developing obesity and many chronic diseases. If you are overfed in early childhood, that increases your predisposition. If you're undernourished in utero, your predisposition to obesity is increased through epigenetics. Then there are myriad behavioral factors, like if your parents are physically active, if they pattern, you know, a way of life that involves physical activity, you're more likely to pattern your life around physical activity. Physical activity is probably less important than food in relation to putting on excess weight, but it's still important because it patterns appetite, for example. And then a range of factors like inequality, social deprivation, economic deprivation, poverty, child abuse, all of them are related in some way to behaviours that associate with obesity.
Yeah.
I mean, you graduated in psychology, so you'd understand that, you know, many of these psychological factors have many different correlates in other areas, including eating. And if we look at obesity in relation to eating, many people comfort eat. Many people eat for distraction. Many people eat when they're just trying to reduce their stress levels. I remember as a student, I could sit down and revise, and I put a box of cookies, let's call them McVitie's Digestives, and start to revise, and 2 hours later, the packet was gone. Similarly, in recent times, I would, you know, if I'm driving any distance, I would put, you know, food next to me, and similarly, I'd find that a whole box of something not very healthy could be consumed without me even realizing. Now, I still have that behavior, but I've simply replaced bad food with fruit. And so I just end up eating a lot of stuff that is probably healthier for me. So there's all kinds of things that serve to promote obesity. Comfort, because ultra-processed foods, foods in high in sugar, high in fat, salt, very ultra-palatable foods are extraordinarily comforting, and they're also very cheap and very, very affordable, very, very affordable. In many stores in the United States, you go to a drugstore in the United States and you say, well, what can you buy that's you might call food? Well, potato chips, crisps, all kinds of sweets. Healthy food, well, it's rather limited. And yet these are the local corner stores that, that people have available to them. In the UK, the small shops are awash in sugar, awash in sugar. Walk down an aisle in a supermarket, you'll see how much sugar and refined carbohydrate there is, all masquerading as different kinds of foods that are put together in different ways. So we have a so-called obesogenic environment that we live in, and that provides another context. We might have predispositions, might have been, you know, not breastfed, might have been born at low birth weight, might have lived in a deprived household. The food that people can afford is ultra-processed food, and so this becomes the typical diet that then becomes reinforced, you know, across time and across generations, if that's helpful.
Yes, that's extremely helpful. And let's just talk a little bit about methodology. I mean, the vast majority of the interviews I've been doing have been medical science departments, and, you know, people are in labs and do things with pipettes. How does an anthropologist collect data?
Well, I like to think that I and the people I work with practice mixed methods. That is, try to be savvy in both qualitative and quantitative methods. And that is, we don't necessarily have to know how to use the quantitative methods, but know how to talk to somebody who makes numbers sing. And so being able to interpret those numbers and to be able to understand what those numbers are saying. And even there, you see, out of the numbers has to come a narrative. So we're thinking about those narratives that emerge out of those numbers. And the second part of that are narratives themselves, the stories that people tell. We have storytelling brains. Everything that we tell in life is a story. I'm telling a story right now. I'm being encouraged to tell a story right now, which, if you got me to do this tomorrow, might go in a different direction. But I'm here now and telling my story. So understanding narratives, and, you know, always in relation to what it is you want to know. In relation to a pandemic, it was shifting towards...
Oh, we haven't quite got there yet.
Yeah, but yes. Okay.
Hang on a minute.
Yeah, well, in relation to... Okay, narratives tell us something about the worldview of a group of people. They tell us something about how people understand a problem. And you become very good at asking people how they see something rather than having an answer yourself. It's actually a very good managerial tool as well, because oftentimes people have the answers within themselves. So quantitative, I mean, I used to be good at quantitative methods. Now I just try to find the best quants people I can. And qualitative, understanding the narratives, we have something that I've helped develop called cultural consensus modeling, and that is using a quantitative method to come to the narratives. So, for example, if I ask you the question, how many Santa Clauses are there in the world? Actually, that's an ambiguous question, because there's obviously, okay, if I ask you a question, is that thing out there a tree? You'd probably say yes.
Yes.
Okay, now I don't need to talk to two Georginas to know that that's a tree. It's common knowledge that that thing out there is a tree. So I just need a sample of one. Oh, a better question. Actually, a better question is who is the Prime Minister, but that's ambiguous too.
So difficult. That's, I'm not so old that I can't answer that question correctly.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. But you know, usually, if I ask the question, who is the Prime Minister, most people would come up with the same answer. So you just need a sample of one. If something is ambiguous or could have multiple answers, then you ask more people. And then you start to see, well, what is the consensus answer? What is the consensus view around this particular issue? So similarly, with narratives, we see how themes emerge. And usually, you know, in quantitative methods, you have power analyses to get an idea of how many people you should see for to get a statistically significant effect. In quantitative methods, apologies, in qualitative methods, I'd make the comparison with doing a literature search. For example, if I want to know something about epigenetics and obesity, I start reading the literature. I know nothing, but I'm intelligent. I could read the literature. I go read the literature, and when I get to the point where a kind of citation loop starts to emerge, where people are citing each other, I feel that I've actually surrounded the literature. Similarly, with a narrative analysis, I ask you a certain number of questions about doing podcasts, for example, and I'll go to the next podcaster and I'll ask same types of questions again, and I'll get similar answers, but I'll get some difference there. And after I've talked to a dozen podcasters, I might say, well, the next person I'm going to talk to is going to come out with these three things. There may be other things, but they will be in common. And then I'll know that I've kind of surrounded, I have the consensus around this particular issue. So that's how it goes. Mm. But you can't always achieve saturation, as you might call it. You can't always achieve that level. You can do your very best. And then having done your very best, you disclose all your failings in your publications, as a good scientist should.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Oh, that's wonderful background. Thank you. So I'm asking everybody this. Can you remember when you first heard that COVID was a thing, that there was something going on in China that looked as if it might be serious?
I would say it was bubbling around in the media. I had just come back from Slovenia. I'm a winter swimmer. So I'd just come back from the winter swimming championships in Slovenia, which were not actually that far away from the spreading event of COVID-19. We didn't
Absolutely.
Know that at the time.
Yes, yes.
I didn't develop COVID-19.
So this was
by the
February, was it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I was down at Day's Lock in Oxfordshire, down near Whitnam Clumps, actually going for a swim, would you believe, with a group of people. And we were crossing one of those country turnstiles, you know, gates where people, you know, come and go. The gate opens half and people go
kissing
in.
Kissing gate. It's called a kissing gate.
What are they called?
A kissing gate.
Kissing gate.
Yes.
Well, I didn't kiss anybody. And you know what? I knew it was probably good not to kiss anybody at that time. But people were avoiding the kissing gate. People were suddenly hugely distanced. And that was the first that I noticed. Within a few days, we were all doing the COVID dance on streets, where you were kind of separating yourself from other people, crossing the road, and you could see how people's trajectories were changing, and sometimes not even saying hello because your friend could be your enemy. And so this kind of hyper sensitivity, this alertness to what was around you. And then during that week, I think later, I may be conflating weeks because, of course, you know, like everybody else, I'm trying to forget the pandemic now. It was the last week of term, and a few days later, the university closed down the following week. We were told that morning on, I believe it was a Tuesday, don't cite me if I've got this wrong, but it was in that morning we were told grab everything that you need because at 4 o'clock the department's closed with a capital C, closed. And so, you know, we were scarpering off with everything. I was giving my last lecture of term, and it was on eating and obesity. And what I usually do in this lecture is I hand around chocolate because I get people to put some chocolate in their mouth and I ask them to think about it. And I illustrate feed-forward mechanisms and feedback mechanisms. So I mentioned chocolate, and feed-forward mechanisms, neural feed-forward mechanisms are you know, already, people are already eating their chocolate in their brain. They have a sense of what this chocolate will be. And then when the chocolate comes, I get them to describe this particular taste. And then having described that, I ask other people if then they say, I want to eat some chocolate, because what they've described is suddenly making them want chocolate. So going through all of those mechanisms. And then, because I would go then on to how, you know, major merchants of burgers, for example, strategize all of these approaches, behaviors, if you will. And nobody took chocolate. Nobody. Okay, zero.
Has that never happened before?
Never, never. You know, in my life, that was a marker. You know, if a class full of students refuses free chocolate, that means something's happening on this planet. So that was my kind of okay. I'm still not certain whether I should have given that lecture or not, but you're there, it's the last lecture of term, you want to finish things off and all the rest of it. It was, you know, just before the pandemonium set in.
And at what point did you start to think that there was a research question now, but with lockdown going on, there was something interesting to explore?
The moment lockdown hit, because I had this group of beautiful people I work with, and I'll name them. Caroline Potter, I've been working with her for well over a decade. Sabine Parrish, Karine Ellie, Anna Lavis, Paulina Nowicka, who are part of my research group, the Unit for Biocultural Variation and Obesity, which is studying these non-medical aspects of obesity. And we had just finished the analysis of a study on physical activity in domestic space. The big question there was, how far should public health go? Where is the public in public health? Should public health actually be in the domestic space? With lockdown, public health knocked down the front door and went straight into the lounge room. So we said, okay, we've got this amazing team of people. We've just done a study of physical activity in the domestic space in Oregon. And you know, we're using quantitative and qualitative analyses, using the mixed methods. And then we said, well, we can do something. So the Social Sciences Division had an emergency response fund from the ESRC, and we put in for this money. And we were already placed to do this work because we had a methodology. We had a question. We had access to the Knowledge Exchange Unit at the UK Parliament. And you know, we felt that a number of pieces were in place to make it work. And we got the money, and then we were running.
So what was the design of the study?
It was quite straightforwardly an electronic questionnaire survey. We put it together from, you know, existing questionnaire surveys. We validated it with a small number of individuals across the university. And then we put it out using a, you know, standard platform for questionnaire surveys advertised by the University of Oxford, and with the aim of reaching 1,000 people. Because there were two things. The work needed to be done quickly if it was going to be useful. And we could have the best survey ever, but usually this kind of survey takes a year, maybe longer. And we did the survey work in June and July of 2020, and we were reporting on it by the end of July. Mm. We had things to say that were useful to UK Gov, and that was the most important thing.
The platform had already done the work of establishing that your sample of 1,000 people was reasonably representative.
Well, the representativeness is tricky. It's always going to be tricky. I don't think our sample was representative, because of course you get mostly people who have the time to do this. Now, of course, you say lockdown, everybody has the time, but there were some people in really desperate straits, and I don't think we reached them. We reached, I think, predominantly middle-class people, and we had an indicative sample that suggested there were issues going on even among the middle classes, and therefore, whatever really was going on there was going to be a lot worse. So you can't reach everybody, and nor did we have the time to be able to do that. As I say, it was a bit like an exit poll for an election. We can't have better than that, but you know, it's good enough to be able to say, look, these seem to be the issues. And it seemed from working, you know, with government in the UK, but also government in Denmark, that politicians like to have some sense of what the issues are, even if they're not really nailed down in terms of you know, statistical significance and validity and so on. That is, it needs to be good enough. And, you know, as I've said, you know, as an anthropologist, you say, well, you know, we know that all of these things are socially constructed. There's no perfect survey. There's no perfect answer. We could give ourselves a year to get everything that we want to do a very elegant analysis of what happened across the pandemic, but we'd be reporting it in a journal of history. And that's not what we wanted to do. And that's not what we were charged to do. We were charged to, you know, come up with some views on what was happening right now.
Mm-hmm. So what were the questions, the key questions that you were asking?
Oh, the key questions were in relation to physical and mental health. Physical and mental health, because it was the way that the government framed the issue. They were interested in the relationship between the two. So we very much framed things in those contexts. So compared to pre-lockdown experience, what happened in terms of your mental health? So anxiety, poor sleep, persistent sadness, binge eating, thoughts of suicide, changes in diet. Some people ate extraordinarily well. Some people did not, quite the opposite. And even in this middle-class sample of 1,000 or so people, mostly in the south of England, we got this U-shaped relationship. You know, if you were in a nice house in West Oxfordshire and had enough backyard, and had enough space, it could be good. And, you know, honestly, looking back on it, I think I had a pretty good pandemic. I had purpose. I had an income. The children came home, they had their own stories to tell, and they were actually having a much worse time of it than we were. And that was another issue that came out. The people that seemed to suffer most in mental health were younger people, young adults, than older adults. Possibly because younger adults are in a state of insecurity, in general life anyway, that we are in a set of conditions now where young people don't get contracts for life. People are on short contracts. A lot of people were furloughed. They didn't know. A lot of people lost their jobs. They didn't know what was going to happen. My son, he had gone to do VSO in Tanzania, gone for 2 weeks and was straight back. And said, well, now what do I do? Well, actually, things have turned out pretty, you know, quite decently for him. He took a few risks during, not in terms of health, but in terms of finding a job and so on, and things have turned up. But there was so much insecurity at that time. So some people we did fine. There were other people. What was telling was that I'm a member of at the time it was an online choir. So Saturday mornings we'd sit down and sing together online. And it could be a cacophony, but at least it was the, you know, the usual people. And, you know, there were people who were in a high rise somewhere in Peckham, for example, and they really couldn't get out, couldn't do stuff. And, you know, intelligent people, just desperate, not able to do anything. West Oxfordshire, one of the wise things, I think, that came out of the lockdown advice, although it differed and was so strange at times and tipped backwards and forwards. One good piece was the one time for physical activity every day, because you could interpret it how you want. What did I do? What did we do as a family? I would cycle 5 kilometres to a lake, swim, and then cycle back again. One piece of activity. As long as I didn't stop, did it all in one go. And I met other people who were doing the same thing. In West Oxfordshire, there are no cars on the road. People on bicycles were happy. They were smiling. They'd taken the roads and were able to, you know, express themselves on bicycles and get their physical activity. But other people really did not have that. So there were two populations, really, I think. In terms of physical health, of course, eating badly, increasing body weight, it seemed there were two possibilities. There were either angels or devils, or there were people who practiced angelic behavior during the day and devilish behavior after 6 o'clock when the gin bottle came out. And so both of those things seemed to be going on at the same time. So its utility, I think, was to be able to give timely information that government might or might not choose to use, depending on what the priorities are. Not the kind of scientist that thinks that what I say or do is the most important thing on the planet. It isn't the most important thing on the planet. Politicians have to think on their feet and decide what's important at a given time. But to be able to offer insights into what is going on to help correct decision making. Now, of course, I can't speak to how politicians make their decisions, but I can at least try to be the best social scientist I can to be able to give the best kind of information that might be acted upon if it's deemed appropriate.
So what, I mean, was there, did you make recommendations for advice that might be given to people who were in lockdown to support their mental health or their physical health?
Well, the initial insight reports, there were two of them, was simply reporting on what had happened, which was negative mental health since the start of lockdown measures. I mean, that can be acted on. Say, well, if lockdown is harming people, then we should be thinking about minimizing lockdown in any way. So the balancing act between holding back the pandemic versus locking people down is walking a tightrope, because governments just have to think, well, there's more than one outcome. And there's also what people think is an important outcome as well for politicians. Contrast that with a friend of mine, John Speakman, who's one of the top obesity geneticists on the planet, who works in Shenzhen in China. And he'd been there across most of the pandemic, and where they had just locked people down. They'd sometimes just told at very short notice that, okay, you're going to be in your apartment. People just took it, and they went and locked themselves down. And of course, more recently, there's been revolt in China because people have had enough.
But it's just gone on such a very long time, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And so that kind of zero COVID approach in China might have seemed appropriate in the early days when China was doing all the right things, early interventions, in a draconian manner, I have to say. It wouldn't happen like that in the UK because people would be too outspoken. People would probably break lockdown and not take part and rebel against it. One of the early reports from UK Gov in the first couple of weeks from lockdown was stated quite clearly that the police would not be able to enforce a lockdown, that it's unenforceable. Therefore, we rely heavily on the public doing their duty, that there will be social and moral pressure would enforce the lockdown. And that actually worked very, very effectively.
It did happen, didn't it? Yes.
Very, very effectively. Mm. And, you know, every country is different. And that seemed to be the right thing, that up front they declared we cannot enforce this, meant that we have to find a different way of soft policing the pandemic. Now, if there's going to be one particular outcome from this pandemic, is in relation to policing, oddly enough. How should something be policed? And there's an awful lot of consensus policing happens in the UK, and I think, I may be wrong, I don't know, but I think the opportunities for consensus policing have only increased. And, you know, it's a good thing for civil society, I believe, to have that. Decreased physical activity, well, that came out early on. And, of course, these recommendations for, you know, getting, you know, one piece of physical activity, whatever you deem that to be helpful. Because, you know, my idea of physical activity will be very different to yours, Georgina. You do what will make you feel better. And get out and do what will make you feel better. Mm-hmm. So it allows that individualism of choice, mm-hmm. that opportunity to choose how you're going to express your physical activity. And then, of course, increased binge eating, consumption of processed snacks, and increased consumption of alcohol. There was a comparison made between the usual mass shopping event in the UK, which is Christmas time, with stockpiling or mass shopping during the pandemic. So we did some very nice work on stockpiling. Because nobody said they were stockpiling, it was always somebody else. And so we've got some very good data.
So that was included in your survey, was it, the question?
Not in the survey, but it's now we're now writing this up for publication.
Oh, right.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. So now we're in the stage of our work where we're considering what we have done and to be able to say, well, lessons learned, lessons for the future. Mm. What are the things that we need to do? Alcohol followed later. Whereas at Christmas, the alcohol buying is all up front. Alcohol and ice cream all followed after, you know, stocking up with the, you know, stocking up for the siege, dry pasta and tinned tomatoes,
paper.
Toilet paper,
yes.
all of those things. But also that poor eating and reduced physical activity contributed to the negative mental health mm-hmm. in the pandemic. That it was not just poor eating, reduced physical activity, it was everything in a totality, mm-hmm. everything working together.
And did you collect figures on body weight? Do you ask people to tell you what they were?
Tricky to do. We really couldn't segregate the population that well to be able to say, well, it's in relation to body weight. In fact, for the insight reports, we produced two insight reports. I don't think it was helpful. But what did happen going into June was that after the Prime Minister of the time developed COVID-19, he was told very clearly that his personal body mass index would have contributed significantly to his extreme state in intensive care, close to death. He suddenly changed his mind on the national food strategy. The national food strategy was something that was being developed in relation to Brexit, and that it was a re-examination of, you know, how we could increase localization of the food system and how we could become more independent of Europe, in inverted commas. And so not a year previously, the Cabinet Office declared that obesity was not going to be in the National Food Strategy. It's, you know, too much nanny statism. The moment the Prime Minister was out of hospital, suddenly obesity was back in the National Food Strategy. So we, myself included, were then racing to bring obesity into the National Food Strategy. So it became a Part A, because Part B had to then deal with the Brexit stuff. Part A was about what happened during the pandemic and its relationships to obesity. So there was, you know, the ill health of lockdown, eating the wrong things, people putting on weight, and then developing the disease, and then the likelihood of developing a severe form of COVID-19. Because obesity is an inflammatory state, and what the virus did was promote inflammation, and so you got this hyper-inflammatory can't even remember what the term is, but there's definitely a term for the you know, Met inflammation that happened with people who developed severe COVID. And so, you know, there was a, they called a cytokine storm. All of the proteins that were associated with, you know, getting the immune system up and running, charging ahead and damaging tissue in many, many parts of the body, including the heart, including the lungs. And so respiratory infections, because, you know, the respiratory distress, because it was attacking the tissues of the body. So, and obesity was part of that. Again, as I said, I'm not on the medical side of this, but we could see the importance of this and we see how it fed into that. The economic insecurity was certainly an issue that came out with our subsequent follow-up report. And then when we took into account economic insecurity...
So you went, did you go back to the same people again and
yes, we did. Yes, we did.
After how long?
That's a good question. I think it was in the second half, towards the second half of July.
Right.
Mm. Yeah. As I say, memory gets hazier, especially when it's stuff you really don't want to be thinking about anymore. Want to be moving on. But I'm proud and happy to have done the work, but I feel that, you know, we now need to be moving into the future. But when we took into account economic insecurity, the young people still had worse mental health outcomes, even when we control for that. So it's something that was much more of a universal thing. And we had lots of narratives that we could just put a few of these into the report, and the stuff that we are, you know, putting into the papers now. You know, here's one, a woman in the southeast, 67 years of age, comfort aid to block out the black thoughts. I comfort aid to stop my brain. Mental health, which has always been my gremlin, reared its head. No control on eating, exercise, or life. And those were, that's just one of many, many, many similar kinds of stories. Increased lethargy, a return to depression that had been under control, forgetfulness, irregular sleep, massive anxiety, amplified bad habits, amplified addictions. That's a man.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just so telling, story after story after story. And of course, because we had a narrative section to the questionnaire, we just said, just, you know, say what you feel you need to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then
did you find those sections were very fully filled out?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. People were happy to talk. In fact, I don't believe that people had very many places they could talk in the early pandemic, because you had to put on a good face. And so publicly, you know, you have to put on a good face, you have to be positive, you have to, you know, this country, I believe, I've never been in this country when there was a war on, but it went on to a wartime footing where people are, you know, making do and mend, and they start to say, well, you know, we have to, you know, dig for victory, all those metaphors and so on. It had that kind of feel to it. Clapping for the health workers, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, when people went back home, then they were there with themselves and their thoughts, and, you know, it wasn't a good picture.
Hmm. So what have you moved on to? I mean, I know you say you want to forget that work, but has it informed the choices you've made about what to do next?
Well, I was asked to give evidence to a House of Lords committee on post-COVID futures, and I said, well, we have to look to multi-level approaches to overweight and obesity. We have to move beyond silver bullet responses. And we, some of my group, we published in The Lancet on, you know, silver bullet won't do it for the pandemic. We need a vaccine, of course we do, but that's not the end of it. I wasn't astonished, but actually appalled by the vaccine deniers that emerged as the vaccine was being rolled out, that it showed a kind of fission in society, some of the fissures that showed insecurity, inequality, it was one of these lightning bolt events that really showed the weakness in society and its strengths. I mean, the strengths were the things that were celebrated, but you know, there are a number of things that show, you know, we really can do better. And I think economic insecurity is a major issue for everybody, but especially for younger people. And I'm a big fan of the Nordic welfare states. I've just come back from Copenhagen, where somehow they seem to do all the right things and have a strong economy. And so why can't we be that kind of neoliberal society that has a strong welfare state? You know, child-centered policies, focusing on the things that make people happy, which is actually mostly other people and family. Money matters, of course it does, but it's not the thing. I feel we should move away from fetishizing money. It's useful, but it's a tool, it's an instrument. And this operates in relation to obesity, but I've been working with colleagues in Sweden and Denmark on insecurity and childhood obesity, and we've developed a new model that shows all the trigger points for the development of childhood obesity, in which insecurity is major. So that's been the biggest thing that's come out very, very recently. Carry on work with on obesity. I'm currently writing a popular book on understanding obesity. And if you'd have asked me before the pandemic if that would have been a thing for me, probably not. But actually writing something that can help to explain complexity and why you are not to blame for your fatness is a very useful thing at this stage. And I think that, you know, I've been told by the publishers just to write what I know, don't think too much. The risk as an academic is always to overthink things. So simplify things down.
It's because at the media level there's always this difficulty in balancing not blaming the person for their overweight while still saying it would be better if you were a bit thinner.
Yeah. Well, that's tricky, because people know they could be a bit thinner. You're not telling them anything they don't know. And you know, when in some places they talk about the war on obesity, well, think about it. It's a civil war. It's a war on obese people, and therefore it's against promoting the health and well-being and goodness of people who carry excess weight. And you know, it's actually very difficult. Unless you've got the genes to avoid putting on weight, it's very difficult to keep your weight down. People who have control of their lives are better able to do that than people who don't. It's very, you know, it's very, very simple and very straightforward. Podcasts. I did podcasts with St. Cross College people who were involved in some aspect of work against the pandemic. A number of them, including now Sir Andrew Pollard and Achilles Ligoxigakis and Mike Parker, who's on Sage, to name but three. Rana Mitto talked about...
And is that something you just do because of your interest in storytelling? I mean, this is something you've chosen to do, that you do these short podcasts for St. Cross College.
Well, with my obesity unit, UBVO, we've been doing podcasts since 2007. There's over 180 that are up on the university website, and even more on Spotify. So, or newer ones, or. Are on Spotify, so there's very much a taste for that, and we've been working with that. So I like podcasting as a medium. We also did with a former student of mine a series of podcasts called Lockdown Food.
Oh yes, I had a note to ask you about that. What was that about?
Oh well, ordinary people and experts. Esther Gonzalez Padilla talked about sugar and how, you know, it's so easy to overeat on sugar. She does her research on sugar. Giles Yeo, who's the sort of media scientist in Cambridge, talked about eating during the pandemic and his approaches, but also somebody who runs a small distillery in New England, who suddenly moved his gin to hand wash, you know, a sanitizer. People in the food industry who were suddenly furloughed and, you know, not involved in food service, the shift of food service provision from the food service area to everyday consumption. So online shopping became a thing, and so bigger thing than it ever had been before, but people weren't just buying from supermarkets. They were buying from, you know, if you could afford it, you could buy from top-end suppliers who'd be supplying some of the top restaurants. I have to confess, I did that, and so did Jars Yeo. But that kind of thing has long-term implications because people are shifting how they're doing their shopping. The emergence of smaller shops, of greengrocers as well, okay, a middle-class phenomenon. It's not cheap, but it signals a purpose, a new purpose, which is to return to a sane food system where we know what we eat. Those are all good things, and I think some of that has stuck. We question what we're eating more. I think everybody's questioning. Even people who are, you know, overeating on the wrong kinds of ultra-processed foods, they know what they're doing, they know what's happening. And actually, I think we're getting closer to a food system that might actually do us good.
Well, we might get there a bit quicker if we didn't have a cost of living crisis going on at the same time.
Well, you can't control for that. And the thing is that the crises, there will be more and more. We did a talk on the pandemic, and we said, well, it's the four horse riders of the apocalypse. Okay, so what have we had? Okay, the four horse riders of the apocalypse are death, famine, war, and plague. Just when he thought it was safe. The pandemic, well, is over, but the disease is kind of normalized in many ways. But there will be more of these episodes, so we have to get used to these shocks.
Yes, indeed. So that was going to be my next question, is how, to what extent do you think the country is better prepared for the next one when it comes along, because it will come. Everybody says, yes, it will come along. It might be in 5 years, might be in 15 years, might be in 50 years, but the next one will come along. And have we learnt enough from this one to be prepared?
Well, honest view?
Yes, please.
On December the 15th, 2022, that we were very well prepared for a pandemic in the early 2000s. The system for reporting potential pandemics was systematically dissolved, maybe not even systematically, but funding was withdrawn and it became seemingly less important because, you know, other things seemed to be more important. Right now, I think this country is very vulnerable because these systems of reporting, there's been a lot of lip service, but I think there's been also, talking about the UK, an awful lot of political turmoil. And I think the political infighting that's been happening hasn't served the country very well. Don't want to be political, but I think while the politicians are trying to work out who their leader is, not much else can really be resolved. Some things can be, but this is an important thing that needs leadership, and hopefully we have a leader now. The others, in my view, seem to be a little bit wanting. It's not for me to criticise. Being a politician is one of the toughest jobs on the planet, but it's a time for ramping up these things and seeing what are the things that need to be thought about, what need to be resolved, what systems need to be put in place. With a war, who can tell? I think one of the important things that I feel ought to be put in place is a move away from just-in-timeism. You know, that we have production systems where things get there just in time, including the supermarket shelves. especially the supermarket shelves. And with a global supply chain, that can work beautifully, or it can just collapse like it did during the pandemic. I've spoken to supermarket leaders in this country and in other countries where they are talking about how to reduce their supply chain and to improve health in that supply chain. So that means lots of localisms. So the localism of having the corner store is great, it's fantastic. Love the corner store. But having the major supermarkets also thinking about how that can be done and making it good for business is I think hugely important. Moving away from just-in-timeism also means a bit more of a Victorian over-engineering, in my view. We're still living off the legacy of Victorian times of, you know, having good building infrastructure, having good roads, over-engineering so many things that actually we've been living off that capital for a long time. And honestly, I saw a broken pipe yesterday, water pipe on the Banbury Road the other day, and I thought, well, goodness me, you know, this system of water delivery even is failing us. Mm-hmm. So,
complete disaster in Sheffield the other week when the water got into the gas system. Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wish the politicians and the policymakers and the public service who support all this the very best in making this work. This is a time for difficult decisions, and I think people are probably prepared for it. But, you know, we need the leadership to be able to, and clear vision to be able to take us forward. And as I say, the one thing that I can do is supply evidence. Mm-hmm. It's the one thing that I can do. And understanding obesity, thinking about multi-level approaches to it, structuring the issue in a way that multiple levels of intervention can be put in place. I think that's where I would place myself now. I was at a meeting of the Royal Society just a few weeks ago. It turned into something of a consensus meeting, causes of obesity. Privileged to be one of the 20 or so that gave presentation. And it felt very much that we are moving towards that kind of, you know, de-blaming the individual. Mm. It's very easy politically to say it's individual responsibility. You don't have to do anything. You just say, well, it's individual responsibility. Let's look at the systems. Who's producing ultra-processed foods? Why have we moved to... In fact, there was one paper on how on earth did we get here, by Kevin Hall in the United States, world expert in obesity physiology. How on earth did we get here? Well, step by step. I mean, the road to hell is paved with bad intentions as well as good intentions. Mm-hmm. But we have to look where we put our feet.
And I mean, this is a more philosophical question, but do you think, sorry, have you got what it is 4:10? Do you need to be somewhere else? No. Do you think there's an increasing recognition that medical approaches are not enough, and that there doesn't need to be a much wider multidisciplinary approach to tackling public health generally and obesity in particular?
Well, I think medical approaches are important, and one day there might be a silver bullet for obesity, but we've seen with the COVID-19 vaccine, the rollout of the vaccine is hugely important, but there are also social implications. There are people who will be vaccine deniers, and there will be people who do not want to take the medication. And you can't assume that it will fix everything. So new technologies offer new possibilities, but we have to think about the context in which those technologies emerge. So if obesity medication is developed, who's producing it? It'll be, you know, pharma probably. That's okay. But then it depends which pharma, who and where. And then it depends which medical system is it feeding into. Is it going to be into a National Health Service, or is it going to be into a free market, free for all. Those social contexts are not sort of casual social contexts. They all have a history, and therefore there is scope for deep analysis of what will happen if you have a particular kind of intervention. Then you have the markets that respond to a new form of medication. The vaccine has done wonders for pharmaceutical companies generally, and their positioning on the markets. But there's also the possibility of cheating, like I can't remember in California the overclaiming for one startup, and now the CEO of that company is I don't know if she's in prison. She might well end up in prison because she's defrauded an awful lot of money, and she's given false promises for a device that should be able to diagnose all chronic diseases. Of course, we want those good news stories, but if you're open to liking those stories, if you're open to wanting to have those sort of silver bullet solutions, then you might not look too carefully at the small print. So, in that context, I think the regulators are hugely important, that the regulation of anything is properly scrutinized. And I think also related to that, I mean, I'm reinventing a world in some ways, that the data that is used to validate a new form of medication ought to be somehow publicly scrutinized. You should be available publicly, and that would also create new problems, because you might say vaccine deniers will then go and look at this evidence and say, actually, I can interpret this completely differently. So every step of this is not fail safe. It can create new problems. We're into a world where huge amounts of data is being gathered. Data is the new gold, and of course the systems that data is used in are varied, and their social implications are large. So I don't see an end to the utility of medical anthropology, shall we say, for example.
No.
Something indeed. We do very well here at the university.
Exactly. I think what I was driving at was that the balance between investment in medicalized approaches and investment in more socially oriented approaches to health seems to me to be somewhat out of whack at the moment, and addressing issues such as inequality and even things like provision of childcare in children's centres and so on could have a huge impact on public health.
Social approaches to medicine can work very well when there's a social approach to society at large.
Yes.
So social approaches work incredibly well in Denmark. Incredibly. During the pandemic, there was a kind of shopping blaming in Copenhagen. So somebody would go into a store and buy two packets of pasta, and somebody behind him would say, "Do you really need that second packet?" There was no hoarding in Denmark, because it was against the common good.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about what is that common good? We have to think, well, if we are giving something up for ourselves, who are we giving it to or for? And I think in the UK, there needs to be a strong focus on thinking about what society is, what kind of society do we want, what kind of communities do we want? Because these are all under challenge and under question, because, especially we have the internet, we have mobile devices, which means our sociality isn't necessarily local. We might live in a house where we don't know our neighbours, but we know thousands of people on our different social media sites. We might even be sitting around the same dinner table but checking our phone, and therefore being here but not really being here. There's no answers to these things, but the question is, what kind of sociality would allow a social solution to something? So, and I think during the pandemic, lots of people came together, and that was beautiful to see. And the positives of it were that actually people do value social fabric, people do value other people, people do value being able to be happy by giving to other people. And how do you promote that when there's no longer a crisis? Do we have to go back to business as usual, which is me, 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 or can we rethink how we do things? Yeah, I think there's a lot of that going on anyway.